Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Douglas Rath. I'm the court-appointed attorney for Willie P. Dabney. This was a jury trial. Mr. Dabney was found guilty of being essentially a felon in possession, unlawful possession of a firearm. The main issue, or at least one issue that I want to address, is the government needs to be complimented at the time of the jury trial for bringing to the court's attention that the two main Chicago police officers, Coleman and Washington, potentially were under investigation. The U.S. Attorney's Office asked the court, after four jurors had been selected, to recess the jury for 4 months. The judge there said that's unrealistic. Gave the jury, gave the U.S. Attorney's Office essentially one day to conduct its investigation and report to the court. This, to me, is a critical issue because the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I had raised to the court the possibility that these particular officers were being investigated by the U.S. Attorney's Office. They had a very similar investigation that had made the news. These guys weren't named. Once that information came out, I believe that the court had a duty to investigate this further. All we had is that
I understand that. I mean, our courts aren't investigative bodies. What is the court supposed to do?
No.
Hire a law firm or something? Or
no, Judge.
Send the marshals out or what?
Absolutely not. What the court did is that the U.S. Attorney's Office in camera presents to the judge the results of their investigation. I don't ever find out about that. That stays with the court. I didn't ask the court to do anything further. But the fact that information...
Well, I don't understand. You said you wanted the court to investigate. What does that mean?
Well, I wanted the court to... basically, the U.S. Attorney's Office makes a statement in camera that, you know, we were wrong. Actually, I don't know what the statement was. This is the problem. The credibility, the veracity of these officers have been challenged by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Some information is presented to the judge, and that's it. The next day, or on Wednesday, we're back on trial with essentially the judge just saying, let's go forward. I mean, that would be fine, Judge, if this was only one of the errors that occurred in this case. We have the potential veracity of these officers brought into question by the U.S. Attorney's Office. We know for a fact, because of a subpoena that I delivered to the Chicago Police Department, that 29 to 30 internal complaints have been raised against these police officers. I asked Judge Dara, please let me review these complaints. Judge Dara said that's not going to happen.
So what would you have liked, a longer continuance or what?
No, Judge. I would have simply said, can I review these complaints? No, I wouldn't have asked for any continuance. I wanted to review the complaints for the possibility of impeaching these two officers. We now have the possibility that they've committed crimes. We know that the Chicago Police Department has investigated them for 29 to 30 times for something. Again, the veracity of the police officers are called into question. Why is this important? Because the facts of the case...
You can't just cross-examine on the basis of a complaint from the public.
Judge, if the Chicago police...
There must be loads of complaints against police, right?
I'm sure there are hundreds, thousands of complaints, but that doesn't mean that I don't have an opportunity at least to look at these to raise the possibility that they are material. I don't know what they are. That's the problem here. These issues are raised.
A complaint might be material, but you can't cross-examine on a complaint, right? Someone writes in and says the policeman is a liar. How can you cross-examine on that?
I may not, but let's say the citizen says that on May 1st, 2005, the police officer took $300 from me because he stopped me for a traffic violation. I decided to...
What do you do with that, right? What do you do with that?
Well, I think it could have been...
You can't cross-examine on the basis of some unsubstantiated complaint from someone who's arrested, right?
Judge. I am not saying that that alone...
I don't understand what procedure. I could understand why you could complain that there were so many complaints that the judge really should have granted a substantial continuance so that you could investigate. I can see that. Is that what your argument is?
No, I'm not. I'm not saying that...
If all your argument is you should have been given a complaint so you could waive them in front of the jury, I don't think that's persuasive.
Well, Judge, I would say that if that's all I was bringing to this court's attention, fine. That may not be enough. But if I'm bringing to the fact that, again, the U.S. Attorney's Office has challenged the veracity of their own witnesses, at least raise the allegation. We have these complaints. I also raised in the I raised to the district court.
I still don't understand. What did you want to do with a one-day recess?
I didn't ask for the one-day recess.
Why aren't you complaining that you were entitled to a substantial recess? That's what I don't understand.
And then, Judge, even though I did not ask for it, I don't know if that would essentially have made it a waiver issue. The U.S. Attorney's Office requested the four-month continuance. I did not ask for a continuance. But, yes, perhaps that would have been helped my client. But I see my time is rapidly drawing to a close, so I want to just raise the 403 issue. The fact that the state court conviction, for all practical purpose, Gabney is charged and pleads guilty in state court of possession of a firearm. Again, an identical charge to the federal charge. The feds decide at this point, okay, the man has pled guilty to this charge. We're now going to charge him for really what is the same crime. The only element being different is the interstate commerce aspect of it. That gives the feds the separate jurisdictional authority to proceed on this case.
A lot bigger penalty, too, I suppose.
With a much bigger penalty. What we have here is we have the fact that I asked Judge Darrow to keep that out under all circumstances. Once the jury hears this, what are they going to conclude other than the fact that the defendant must be guilty?
Well, yeah, right.
Yes, sure, but that should not...
That seems like a very rational inference.
Of course it's a rash. I'm not arguing so it's not a rational inference. I'm arguing that if you take the errors that I have alleged and take the fact that the facts of the trial boil down to two cops and two independent civilians.
He already admitted, right? He admitted
under
oath.
Yes, he admitted in state court.
You might as well be arguing we shouldn't allow confessions in because if the guy confesses, he must be guilty, right?
No, Judge, I am not arguing that at all. I am saying that this at this point essentially takes the issue away from the jury.
So what? It takes it away because he admitted under oath the crime, except for the interstate commerce. So once the government proves that, his goose is cooked.
Judge, I am saying that if you take all of the various issues I've raised, you have error. That's all I'm saying.
Errors are irrelevant because he admitted under oath that he committed the crime.
Judge, that to me is just one further error.
It would be irrational for a jury to disbelieve him, wouldn't it?
I'm saying it should not
have... testify that he lied when he confessed because he didn't realize he might be prosecuted federally? Is that his theory?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
What is the theory you present? When you have a client who has admitted under oath that he committed the crime, how do you defend him? Do you have him say, yeah, I said that was lying, right?
He never, Darrow.
How do you defend that as a lawyer for criminal defense? How do you defend a person who's admitted under oath that he committed the crime?
Well, I don't know if it ever came into evidence. I don't think it did.
I'm asking you a general question. If there's evidence, if there is unrefuted evidence that he admitted under oath in another proceeding that he committed the crime, how do you defend as a lawyer?
Judge, the way I was able to defend as a lawyer...
I'm not talking about this case. I'm asking you a general question. When you have a client who admits under oath that he's committed the crime, what is your defense strategy?
Judge, You know, that obviously is an extremely difficult case to defend.
I'm asking you a question. Would you answer me? What is the defense strategy in a case such as that?
I put on witnesses to refute what the government said.
I don't understand. The government says he admitted this crime. Now, how do you refute that?
Because the evidence at trial suggested that the defendant, in fact, was not in possession of the weapon.
So why did he admit that he was?
That is a question that I can't answer. I wasn't present at the state court. Defendants will often, in state court, in many court proceedings, will weigh what the consequences are.
And then they'll perjure themselves.
Judge, I'm afraid that defendants sometimes plead guilty because they're so afraid of the consequences. I mean, that's just the reality of what happens here.
What was the penalty in state court?
The state court, he received a 6-year sentence. The government wanted to basically have him do time as an armed career criminal, which started at 15 years and went to life. Dabney decided to plead guilty because he was literally hoping to avoid the federal Safe Projects neighborhood dragnet that simply exists out there. He figured if he pled guilty and took his 6 years, this is known to state defendants, that feds will prosecute these cases even after a conviction. Dabney hoped to fall below the radar screen of the federal government. He was wrong, and he suffered the consequences.
Are those going to be concurrent?
No, I asked for it to be concurrent, and the judge wouldn't allow it to be. He's serving state time right now, and he's not getting any credit for federal time. He'll start his federal sentence upon the conclusion of the state sentence. This, to me, just seems inherently unfair.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Rath.
Thank you.
Mr. Dolier?
May it please the court, my name is Steve Dolier and I represent the government in this matter. Excuse me. The first issue raised by appellant in this case relates to allegations, unsubstantiated allegations.
This box, isn't it that you're putting these people in? If they plead guilty in state court, then they're doomed in federal court. If they don't plead guilty in state court, and they lose, of course, they get a longer sentence. They can still be nailed by the federal government. So doesn't it create quite a dilemma for the defendant when he's charged in state court first?
Potentially.
It's a 1-2 punch. He pleads guilty in state court, and then you've got him nailed for the federal crime.
Well, Your Honor, there's no double jeopardy issue, of course, related to
not.
It.
Of course not. I know that. I'm not talking about that.
Right. Certainly, the admission below is prejudicial in the sense that all evidence reflecting the defendant's guilt is prejudicial. Excuse me. However, it's not unfairly prejudicial, as the court pointed out.
No, I understand. But is this a standard tactic that is... First, the person is prosecuted in state court, and then, I mean, that's really plucking low-hanging fruit, right? The way for all these people to be. In the previous cases I've seen, there was no gun possession, no state gun possession proceeding before the federal.
It's outside the record, certainly, as to whether it's a standard practice, and I certainly couldn't answer, except to go outside the record and perhaps alleviate some of the concern regarding the
sure
offices.
I'm just curious. Yeah.
To answer your curiosity, there's the Pettit waiver process, Your Honor, in which we have to...
Is it what?
A Pettit waiver. It's an internal process in which our local office would go to DOJ and D.C. and seek... permission to pursue this individual, even though a similar charge has been...
So you have to get permission from Washington, is that...
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, going outside the record, Your Honor, that was done in this case, and that that policy was adhered to, and we did receive that permission.
Thanks. I was just curious about that.
Certainly, Your Honor. And again, that statement was certainly properly admitted under 801D2A, Your Honor, and the 403 analysis was appropriate given the fact that it's terribly probative, as the court pointed out previously, that the defendant admitted that he possessed the same gun at issue in the federal trial. Arguably, there's nothing more probative of his guilt other than that his own words in that instance. The next issue, and further, Your Honor, the fact that it was made during a guilty plea was, in fact, barred by the trial court. It was simply a statement made under oath with the presence of counsel. The jury was also instructed with a curative instruction not to speculate as to the circumstances of that statement. So the statement was properly admitted. As far as the next issue that appellant raises is this issue of investigations into two police officers who are government witnesses at this trial, Officers Coleman and Wallace. At the first day of trial, the government pointed out that there were these unsubstantiated allegations related to Coleman and Wallace by one reporting individual. The government asked for an extended continuance. The court granted a one-day continuance to look into these allegations. The government came back and, in an abundance of caution, asked to talk to the court ex parte regarding the nature of their results. In fact, as you'll see in the record at page 78, one of the trial AUSAs actually, when the judge asked the question, what are your results regarding the investigation related to Officers Coleman and Wallace, one AUSA starts and actually does say no, there aren't any, but then after no is actually cut off, and the other AUSA asks, again, an abundance of caution not to disclose who is and who is not a subject of the investigation to be disclosed in open court. Again, if I could, I could certainly go off the record and tell you what the results of the investigation are, but I won't do that. After that disclosure is made, there's no other reference to that in the record. A fair inference, and really the only inference given the government's Brady obligations, is that the results of the government's investigation and any further Brady material or any investigations by our office into Officers Coleman and Wallace was negative, was that there wasn't any information to yield, and therefore the office didn't yield it or provide it to the defense. The second issue, and actually to stay on that issue for a second, this issue of whether the trial court should do its own investigation, that in the defendant appellant's argument in his papers is suggests that that's under Brady. Well, the court doesn't have any Brady duties. The government has a duty to disclose. The courts, under Brady, the government doesn't even have a duty to investigate, simply to disclose information that it does have. And so Brady would not implicate any duty upon the trial court to investigate these unsubstantiated allegations. Then moving on to the second Brady issue raised by the defendant about the 30 complaint registers that were brought into court. Three of those were actually vetted in open court and discussed by the trial court. There was only of all 29 or 30, only one was substantiated, and that was a self-reporting by one of the officers regarding a failure to properly inventory narcotics evidence in a case. The other, the remaining CRs were just unsubstantiated. But as I mentioned, the court did go into two others in addition to the substantiated allegations, and it was determined based on analysis under 403 in conjunction with 608B that this evidence wasn't appropriate for cross-examination. And certainly, as the court previously pointed out, these are unsubstantiated allegations. To the extent that the defendant would have been allowed to simply ask a question regarding these unsubstantiated allegations, it certainly doesn't have any material impact here, given the overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt.
These were all complaints that had been investigated and determined to be unsubstantiated. What do you mean by unsubstantiated? There had been internal investigations and the files were closed, or what do you mean by that?
Unfortunately, the record doesn't indicate exactly what the status of each of these complaint registers was, Your Honor. But there's reference in the record to the fact that there was one substantiated and the others were unwarranted. I believe the inference there is that they were just bare allegations, very similar to the allegations that the government disclosed that were also unsubstantiated regarding Officers Coleman and Wallace. And therefore, after the government's review, it didn't disclose any additional CRs, Your Honor, because they weren't Brady material. If the court doesn't have any further questions, the government would rest on its brief and ask that the court affirm the district court's opinion.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Doyle. So, Mr. Rath, your time had expired, but you can have a minute if you'd like.
Your Honor, one issue that was raised by the defendant, I raised it in my reply brief, whether the court would even consider it, and it goes back to really this low-hanging fruit analysis that you've made, is that when the government starts, you asked one of the reasons, essentially, why did this defendant go to trial? He was facing the potential of 15 years to life as an armed career criminal. The government was simply wrong that he even had this background. And they basically held it over his head. This is the reason they even prosecuted him, because they figured he was an armed career criminal. Not only could we give him the 6 years, we could give him 15 years to life. The government made a mistake as to the background. This defendant was placed into a position where he felt he had no chance but to go to trial. He knew he was going to be found guilty. What jury in their right mind would disregard the essentially admission that he possessed this weapon despite the curative efforts of Judge Darrow? But the defendant was put into a box. He's already been convicted of a state charge. The feds want to prosecute him on something to send him away forever, essentially, and they were wrong about it. That's why this case went to trial. That's really all I have to say. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Rath. We thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client as appointed counsel.